We're talking about cybersecurity. We're just on the back end of National Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and Mark is here to join me to talk about cybersecurity at the agencies. Nice to see you.
Good to be here.
Agencies are struggling. You have a terrific graphic that we're going to link up to at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth that details the timeline of some of the cyber challenges that agencies have come up against over the past 5 or 6 years. I've noticed as I scan down through that graphic, the challenges are not going away, but they seem to at least be diminishing a little bit. And so I take heart from that, because whenever we talk about cybersecurity in government, I think a lot of people come away from these conversations with their heads hung down. Oh, man, it's just so difficult. But do you see a little bit of a maybe light at the end of the tunnel?
We did notice that in putting together the graphic, that there was a cluster 2007, 2008. In the last year and a half, there weren't any major high-profile data breaches, intrusions. Heartening, except when you listen to the Deputy Secretary of Defense say that there's, you know, as many as 70,000 attempted intrusions per day, that even at the civilian agencies, we've got a steady beat of attempted intrusions, of successful hacking, and other security breaches that... maybe there hasn't been the one huge one that catalyzes attention and, you know, makes us journalists notice and, and start digging around. But I think there's a steady drumbeat still. It's good to know that the number of the major ones, at least recently, has gone down. But I wouldn't be resting if I were... in charge of security. Anyway.
Yeah, and I don't get a sense that any agency is resting on its laurels. One of the things I mentioned later on in the hour, we're going to play some comments from Vivek Kundra at NIST yesterday, talking about cloud computing, and that's one area where just about any time you hear the words cloud computing and government security is attached to it pretty shortly after you hear the words cloud computing. Technologically, one of the things, one of your credentials that people might not know about is the book about Google that you wrote, which is called The Google Story: Inside the Hottest Business, Media, and Technology Success of Our Time. And we'll have information about that at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later today, too. But we try all the time to talk about how agencies are trying to innovate, are trying to essentially parallel the private sector. I don't want to say keep up, because that implies something that I think is not really the case, but try to parallel what the private sector does, not just on the web graphically what you can see, but as far as what private sector companies are doing innovation-wise. When we look at what they're seeing cybersecurity-wise, they're having the same challenges that private sector companies are, and I'm not sure that they're really necessarily doing any worse than some companies in the private sector are doing.
No, the private companies, Google at the top of the pack, but certainly any of them that have a major presence in cloud computing, have a major challenge on their hands of being responsible for increasing amounts of data, including public data, governments, that are flocking to the cloud with storage of, in many cases, very sensitive material. They have the ability to, in a sense, spend at will, or spend as their corporate budgets allowed it to keep up. We haven't seen, I think, a lot of big security breaches come out of the private sector yet. The companies have a very good interest in, you know, solving the problems quickly and quietly where they come up, or working with government in the cases where there's partnerships to address the breaches. Google, as you know, the one of the most profitable companies out there, building data centers probably as fast as China's building power plants. You know, they their sole reason for being as trusted as they are is they haven't had the major breach. There have been some privacy kerfuffles here and there, but you know, they've got they're sitting on a vast store, and so far it's been secure. And I think that the public's trust in them has held up. In looking at some of what the cybersecurity experts we've been talking to are looking ahead, coming out of this month with the launch of CyberComm, you see, 15,000 networks alone that, DoD is trying to protect. And the question is, are they putting all of the resources in the right place? Are they, do they have the flexible policy that can address the, the top level oversight, but also trickle down to the average person at their desk?
Yeah.
They, it's both a human problem and a technical problem. We've talked to people that say, this is really a matter of social science as well as technical science.
That's a really good point, and I usually manage to bring cybersecurity conversations around to that, and I'm glad that you've done it for me. You've taken care of that job for me, because I ask people from time to time, how do we, when we have processes and procedures and policies and regulations and technology in place, how do we prevent that one person from sticking the thumb drive in the DoD computer in the Middle East somewhere that Secretary Lynn talked about a couple of months ago now, that wound up infecting a system? It's what's between the ears as much as what's on the network, and trying to negotiate that, as you call it, a social science issue, I think is tremendously interesting. As you worked through this series and talked about it and spoke to people, what kind of progress do you think agencies are trying to make in that area? Or, I mean, you can educate till you turn blue in the face and spend all your money on training, but obviously problems persist.
They all speak about a layered solution. The layers including, obviously, the top level securing the access from a policy perspective, having the physics in place to prevent or thwart the unwanted intrusions. All of the science that I don't understand. But when it gets over to the social aspect, it's a little bit like airline security, where there's layers and layers that we don't see when we're traveling, but are very important to matching up databases of travelers on watch lists. But if we look at some of the major instances where we've been able to stop attacks recently, it's actually been alert humans.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reverse, you look at it, the reverse is true in a computer situation where folks at their desk, they could be the key to allowing an attack to happen by doing something mindless, clicking on a link without thinking about it.
Yeah, yeah. My guest is Mark Malseed of OhMyGov, and he's talking about cybersecurity and innovation. And let's talk some more about maybe some lessons that we've learned on cyber or innovation when we come back on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. It's In Depth with Francis Rose. We'll be back in a moment.
HalfPriceDC.com. Half price gift certificates to the area's best restaurants, spas, and more.
This week, buy half price gift certificates to Tequila Grande of Vienna. Good tasting Mexican food that's fresh, flavorful, original, and pure. Chef Prakash guarantees that.
And Casa Rico's in Frederick, bringing you new, exciting, and authentic preparations from Mexico since 1987. That's 23 years on the Golden Mile.
See all the offers at HalfPriceDC.com.
40 kilometers northwest of Kandahar, Afghanistan, at a remote desert military base, American soldiers are playing video games. There are cold drinks, snacks, comfy chairs, and an internet connection. It's the USO To Go program, and it's just one of the ways the USO supports our troops, lifts their spirits, and serves as a link with the American people. Find out how you can help. Visit us at USO.org. The USO, until everyone comes home.
Here's Judy Spencer, co-chair, Federal Identity Credential and Access Management at GSA, on the Federal Executive Forum on Identity Management, sponsored by UMUC.
I believe we're going to move away from the smart card as the hardware token. I see mobile phones coming into their own. I actually believe that in the very near future there will be an app for that. And it will be my identity credential somehow or other linked into my phone as the hardware token that carries it around.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
On today's new battlefield, your enemy may be halfway around the world or right next door, because today's new battlefield is in cyberspace. That's why universities University of Maryland University College is training an army of cyber warriors. Armed with a bachelor's or master's degree or a graduate certificate in cybersecurity from UMUC. UMUC cybersecurity degrees and certificates provide real-world experience and are offered completely online. Enroll today. Call 1-800-888-UMUC or visit umuc.edu.
The FedCloud blog on federalnewsradio.com takes a look at the issues surrounding cloud computing through the eyes of those who are using it every day. We'll share with you the challenges, opportunities, and lessons learned from some of the top minds in the world of federal IT. Collaborate with others and help shape the discussion on cloud computing at the FedCloud blog on federalnewsradio.com or follow the FedCloud blog on Twitter. The FedCloud blog is sponsored by Cisco and Intel.
Hi, I'm Neil Asbury, host of The Neil Asbury Show. Please join me and my guests each week as we discuss the importance of international trade, entrepreneurialism, small business ownership, job creation, and the American dream.
The Neil Asbury Show, Saturday mornings at 8 on Federal News Radio. The Neil Asbury Show is sponsored by AIT Worldwide Logistics, Yoakum Shore and Trossaven, and WTS, Withers Worldwide Transportation Systems.
What's the buzz in the federal community? Chris Dorbeck knows it. Join Chris for the Dorbeck Insider weekday afternoons 3 to 7 on Federal News Radio AM. Chris has the insights on who's coming and who's going, new memos, new contracts, fun and helpful ways for federal managers to improve agency productivity while meeting mission goals. The Dorbeck Insider, building federal community by connecting people. Weekday afternoons on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest is Mark Malseed of OhMyGov.com and talking about innovation in government, talking about cybersecurity. And one of the things that you mentioned in the last segment I think is really interesting, and that is the idea that people in government by nature, my experience has been, are decent people. They're good people. They're trying to do an important job for the country and so on. What that means is they don't think like the bad guys do. And they don't think necessarily that what they're working with, the data they're working with, the data that they are responsible for protecting, might necessarily be as valuable as somebody else thinks it might be. And I wonder if it might not be good, beneficial for the agencies to start to at least encourage some of their folks to think like the bad guys. In order to think, if I were going to take this, what could I do with it? Is this potentially more valuable than I think it is?
You know, you bring up a great point there, and it's a tough from management perspective to get your employees to start to think that way, but only to a certain point,
yeah.
And then rein them in.
Yeah.
So if they get too good at their criminal
That's
mindset.
True. That's true. If they get really good at it, yeah, then you wind up with a renegade on your hands.
But you also don't want to... I think overly stress people out mm-hmm. in a workplace environment where they begin to fear what they're sharing. You know, that's been the traditional problem of government is not enough information sharing,
yeah.
All the stovepipes in intelligence, but across government. And if you paint a picture of be careful what you're talking about, what you're posting online, what you're sharing, what you're emailing, people may become more reluctant thinking that, oh, well, maybe this PowerPoint is really useful to the enemy.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, yeah, you don't – most people in their jobs have somewhat of a tunnel vision, really, that, hey, this is what I'm working on. You don't see the bigger picture unless you're at the senior management levels
yeah.
and overlooking, you know, the whole agency or sub-agency.
I find it fascinatingly ironic that we're having the information security discussion at the same time we're having the open government discussion. Those two happening on parallel tracks, I think, is really interesting. I mentioned at the beginning of the show that you co-wrote a book about Google, and the title of that book is The Google Story Inside the Hottest Business, Media, and Technology Success of Our Time. Google has been held up all across government, all across, and at all layers of government, and across the private sector as this example for people to follow. Based on the study of Google that you did for the book, are there lessons that agencies can learn about innovation from what Google does? Obviously, the structures are dramatically different, but I imagine there are some best practices that people can take away.
Yeah, I think there absolutely are, Francis. The beginnings of Google look far different from what we see in a government setting. Today's Google, not so much different, because it's now a large company, a huge public company that has to meet quarterly earnings and you go through various layers of management and their own bureaucracy to get ideas out the door. But channeling, you know, the early days, which were obviously when the search engine was invented, the ad engine that fuels our profitability, they did a number of key things that hopefully government can find a way to take some lessons and apply them to a public setting. First being giving their engineers the ability to freelance a little bit of their time within the structure of a company. I don't think we as taxpayers want to give 20% of your average project manager's time to whatever projects, you know, they deem worthy, like Google does. They basically, one day a week, their engineers could freelance on whatever they wanted to. And it created some great products like Google News. So from a taxpayer's perspective, maybe that's not the right one. But the idea that you should put products out quickly, maybe before they're entirely finished, and fail fast and take those lessons, that's a good one, and one that doesn't always sit well with the way government is, you know, is operating because of the legal structures around government that, you know, you have to come out with a product that's been tested or service that meets all the requirements. So, you know, there's other things that do need to change structurally, but I think you can channel some of the best. Push services out the door. Work collaboratively with citizens, with other governments to improve them. And don't expect that on day one it's going to be perfect and wait for either pushing it through with public relations saying, hey, yeah, this is great, or accepting a whole bunch of blame and front page negative press.
Something that we only have about a minute left in this segment. We can continue this conversation after the break. But something else that I have seen them do over the years is roll out stuff in pieces, which is contrary to what the government has done, especially in IT projects, for a long time, where you have this massive 5-year, 10-year project. And we've talked about it a lot lately. OMB is trying to narrow the focus of these IT projects. But that actually fits with what you're talking about the fail fast concept, which is more like where it seems government's trying to go, at least when it comes to things like that.
Yeah, and I think part of that's from the major contractors and the large bureaucracy from the outside bumping up against a large government bureaucracy. Maybe that there's an opening for small businesses to come in. They've got to fail fast or succeed fast, or they'll be out of business.
Or they'll be out of business. Mark Malseed's my guest on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. He is executive editor of OhMyGov.com, and they have a interesting, terrific graphic about cybersecurity that we're going to link up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. And talk about more when we come back from the break on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
I'm Chris Maurer, CNBC Business Radio. Stocks are mixed. The Dow's down 9 points. The Nasdaq higher by a fraction. Pending sales of previously owned homes fell unexpectedly in September, down 1.8%. The National Association of Realtors says activity may remain volatile for months as troubles with foreclosures disrupt the market. The data reflects home sales contracts and not closings. It's seen as a leading indicator of housing market trends. Private companies hired workers at the fastest pace since April. The government says 151,000 jobs were added to the economy last month. That's nearly double what analysts had been expecting, but unemployment remains at 9.6%. And Qantas Airlines says it believes the engine that blew apart on the world's largest jetliner was probably designed or built incorrectly. Once again, stocks are mixed. I'm Chris Maurer, CNBC Business Radio.
At Ally Bank, we don't think it's enough just to offer great rates. That's why we've created a CD with a rate that can get, well, greater.
the Ally Raise Your Rate 2-Year CD. You start off with the rate that is consistently among the most competitive in the country. Plus, you have the option of a one-time increase if our rates go up over the course of the term. Now, when it comes to banking, who wouldn't love that? To learn more about our Raise Your Rate 2-Year CD or to open an account, visit allybank.com or call us at 877-247-2559. Member FDIC.
Could switching to GEICO really save you 15% or more on car insurance? Would helium make opera sound less formal and stuffy?
Quella parrucca, presto la barba.
Tutto mi chiedono, tutti mi vogliono, donna ragazzi, vecchie fanciulle, quella sanguigna presso biglietto. Figaro.
Be like the 4 million who switched to GEICO last year, and you too could start saving money. For a free rate quote, visit geico.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15%.
The Pentagon and Beyond, brought to you by Airink.
The Air Force is planning to develop more high-tech drones that can collect intelligence and better maneuver in the combat airspace, according to the Associated Press. The Air Force has already dramatically increased the number of armed and unarmed drones over Afghanistan and Iraq. Air Force Lieutenant General Philip Breedlove says there are growing worries, and the U.S. needs aircraft that can better gather information and conduct electronic attacks. I'm J.J. Green.
Can you imagine being responsible for the electronic security of up to 1 billion barrels of emergency crude oil stored in salt caverns as deep as 4,000 feet? Airink can. Their advanced information management platform protects over $80 billion worth of crude oil for the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. This stockpile is so important to our national security that there's only one person in the world who can authorize its drawdown. For more information, log on to arinc.com.
This is NIH Health Matters. I'm Joe Belinfi. Scientists estimate that about 59% of the U.S. population have some immunity to the 2009 pandemic H1N1 flu virus. Dr. Anthony Fauci at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases explains, this is because they were exposed to related viruses or vaccines prior to 2009, were immunized against it, or developed immunity following infection.
One of the things people wonder now, as we come through the next cycle, the year after, what is going to happen with H1N1?
He says it is unlikely to come back as a pandemic, but recommends the seasonal flu vaccine for everyone older than 6 months. For details, visit www.niaid.nih.gov. Health Matters is produced by the National Institutes of Health, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Health Advocates. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Nicholas Garlow with HHS HealthBeat. Receiving serious news about your health can be stressful. You're trying to listen to your doctor and ask questions, but you can often be overwhelmed. This is where a health advocate can be helpful. They can be a family member, friend, or trusted colleague. Dr. Carolyn Clancy is the director of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality.
An advocate can help ask questions, write down information, and get the resources the patient needs.
In many cases, a patient can be concerned about the results of a health test they've taken. Dr. Clancy also recommends having an advocate for comfort purposes.
This can be great support for the patient and also help them understand their options.
Learn more at hhs.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Nicholas Garlow.
The March of Dimes and FC Innova will honor women in the tech field who make a difference in their communities at the 10th Annual Heroines in Technology Gala, Friday, November 12th at the Hyatt Regency Reston. From CEOs to entrepreneurs, these women exemplify volunteerism in our community. The keynote speaker will be Dr. Betty Spence, president of the National Association of Female Executives. To learn more about the nominees and to purchase tickets, please visit marchofdimes.com/metroDC. Proceeds will help prevent birth defects, premature birth, and infant mortality.
We're We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're talking about innovation in government and cybersecurity with Mark Malseed, executive editor of OhMyGov. And you obviously have written and talked and so on about social media on the site and especially how it's being used in government. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the direction that you see social media being used in government, both internally with helping employees be able to collaborate and do work, and also the interaction with citizens on the mission end of it?
I'm very optimistic on both fronts. I think the social media is one of the real success stories so far in the open government, government 2.0 movement that led by military, by some forward-thinking agencies, and now really spreading across the government sector, across the political spectrum as well. You've got agencies that realize that they can control and really hone their message to either other governments or directly to citizens by making use of Facebook and Twitter, YouTube, but also other things like SlideShare, where the presentations that they're giving, that you know, a lot of time and energy and good thought has been put into these, they're out there. They're made public. And that's the most, if we talk about direct democracy and really engaging citizens, you know, citizens tend to be starved for information. They don't always want or feel the need to listen to all of the, you know, the news that we put out. But if you empower them to go and read the social media guide that, say, the Navy put out, there's a heck of a lot of good information in there that applies to really any organization trying to address these questions.
President Obama had a tremendous amount of success in his campaign with social media. It attracted a lot of people. He raised a lot of money using it. And some of those theories have been applied by the executive branch in government. Do you see anything coming out of the election that just happened this week that will maybe parallel that, that people at agencies should be paying attention to, or lessons that we can learn in how a technology has evolved in the 2 years since the presidential election, anything like that?
Yeah, well, what's happened in the 2 years since Obama was elected is a lot of tweets and Facebook updates have been posted. And this is public data that a number of organizations, where one of them are collecting. We're crawling this information, storing it, and analyzing it, and discovering some really interesting patterns. And a group out at Hewlett-Packard Labs did a really fascinating study where they were able to predict box office success and failure of movies based on the Twitter activity happening leading up to that release. In this election, we were one of the organizations that looked at social media, fan growth, things like that, leading up to Election Day. And what we identified beforehand came true. There was a, you know, we saw that the House was going to be a big win for the Republicans, the Senate not a win, but gaining some seats back. And regionally, we found that in the Great Lakes region, in the Mid-Atlantic, which were very key areas for Obama's victory in 2008, they swung back, and we saw that in the social media data.
So there's a tremendous amount of predictive power by analyzing the information that comes out of these.
Yeah, and governments, the, you know, agencies are beginning to recognize that. They're the first step is to really recognize what can be tracked, and then how to use it, and to actually start engaging with either their own IT infrastructure or bringing folks from the outside in and saying, we want to collect this, we want to analyze it, let's run various studies, let's try to correlate, see whether the messages we're putting out are being received the right way by the right audience, and if we change, do a little bit of this or that. You know, coming back to Google for a second, one of their big you know, achievements early on in getting good products out the door was doing A-B testing. Put out two different versions of the same thing, see which is more liked by the users. I think government can do that. They can try different messaging. They can put out different aspect, you know, different names for their services, do a better job of branding at a very low cost.
Yeah, that's the where I was going to go next, actually, because one of the things that agencies have already had a some success with is various crowdsourcing projects, and it can be something as mundane as here are some potential regulations and taking comments through an interactive way rather than just having people have to mail them in like the old days. But all kinds of different projects that they've done that are interactive and that are engaging. And I think they've been surprised at the effort and the time and in some cases even the money that people are willing to put in all their own to be able to participate and potentially influence how things are done.
Absolutely. Now, if there's a limitation on social media, it's that it actually isn't free. There's a cost to it, mm-hmm. resources. It needs to be tied into the public affairs office or the CIO's office. You know, it answers to a bunch of masters, mm-hmm. and that is it's a difficult spot to be in government. And there's also legal aspects of, you know, for one that came up this week with the election and the season is the Hatch Act and what you can and can't say mm-hmm. on social media. And there's pretty strict guidelines for federal employees, and it actually trickles down to a number of state and local employees mm-hmm. as well if they're receiving federal funds.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's okay to post your party affiliation, if you identify as a Democrat or Republican or whatever on, mm-hmm. on your profile, it's okay to list your name and your office, but you have to be very careful of where you're linking to.
Yeah.
Especially when you're on government property, but really in many cases anywhere, you can't necessarily pass on links to political advocacy groups.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one gray area that's emerging is it has been okay for you to link to a candidate's homepage.
Mm-hmm.
Say, hey, I support, you know, Joe Smith. But mm-hmm. Now many candidates are putting really prominent contribution requests right on their homepage. And that used to be the difference.
Yeah.
The homepage was okay, but not the contribution page.
Right.
When it's all one and the same,
yeah.
I don't know what's going to happen next time around.
Starts to change a little bit. You've got a great graphic that we'll link up to at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth with some Hatch Act do's and don'ts, too. And I appreciate you being here today. Mark Malseed of OhMyGov.com, the executive editor there. Thanks for coming in. It's great to see you.
Thanks for having me, Francis.
Happy to do it. It's In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. When we come back, we'll take you to yesterday's cloud computing forum and workshop at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. The keynote from Chief Information Officer Vivek Kundra talks about his vision for the role of cloud computing in the federal government when we come back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
How are human services delivered in the District of Columbia? How is D.C.'s Department of Human Services assisting homeless veterans? How is it doing more with less? Join host Michael Keegan next week for an encore presentation as he explores these and other questions with Clarence Carter, Director of the District of Columbia's Department of Human Services. That's next week on the Business of Government Hour.
If you've been around Washington as long as I have, you know the one constant is change. The players change, laws change. If you're a federal retiree or soon to be one, you need to know that some of those changes could affect your retirement future. There's one association fighting to make sure that doesn't happen, and that's NARF, the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association. If you work for or have worked for Uncle Sam, you need NARF. NARF is the only association that's dedicated to making sure your retirement is secure when you reach retirement. Don't wait until after you retire to join NARF. Check out their website at www.narfe.org. You'll see that NARF is a great investment for your retirement future. Then, click on the Join Now button and join hundreds of thousands of federal retirees and employees as a NARF member. Or call them at 800-627-3394, 800-627-3394, and have them send you more information.
Newsmakers talk to Max Kakis.
Lieutenant General Jeffrey Sorensen, Chief Information Officer for the U.S. Army.
The Army has embarked upon an agreement with DISA to provide email service and calendaring service. The Army CRG-6 will move into the cloud here in January. Headquarters DA will do it in February. By the end of FY11, all 1.4 million CAC users that we currently have in the Army will essentially be drawing their services for email and calendaring, etc., from DISA.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive.
Are you on Facebook? Do you Twitter? So does Federal News Radio. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FedNewsRadio or join the Federal News Radio Facebook group. For the latest in federal news and government contracting, visit our website, federalnewsradio.com. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
We're back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and you've heard a lot, I'm sure, about cloud computing at your agency and maybe even have been involved in moving some things in your agency to the cloud. Vivek Kundra, the Chief Information Officer of the United States, talked about cloud computing and the role it plays in the federal IT world at the National Institute of Standards and Technology's Cloud Computing Forum and Workshop yesterday. It was the second of workshops that they've conducted at NIST, the first one back in May, and this one getting underway with remarks first from Dr. Patrick Gallagher of NIST, and then this presentation from Vivek Kundra.
I want to actually thank Pat for the leadership that he has provided, and also Don and Sita and a number of people at NIST who have been very devoted to making sure that as a federal government continues its journey to the cloud, that we're doing so in a very responsible, secure manner. Don attends my weekly meetings on cloud computing. For the last year and a half, I've been having a meeting every week, and on top of that, on a daily basis, keeping tabs on the progress that we're making. What I'd like to do is open up with reflecting on what's happened in the past year and a half when it comes to cloud computing. I still remember my very first CIO Council meeting where I set this as a major priority for the United States government, and the reason was, as Pat pointed out, the U.S. government spends over $80 billion on information technology, yet for too long what we've seen is a history with IT projects that have failed, and they've failed miserably. I've pointed out to failures such as at the Department of Defense, where we invested $1 billion in 12 years on an integrated human resource system that ended up failing. Or if we look at departments across the federal government, where we've invested in duplicative infrastructure year after year. I've pointed out to the growth in the number of data centers from 432 in 1998 to 2,094 today. And that is one of the reasons cloud computing is a major priority for this administration. But it's not just a priority based purely on economics. It's also a priority based on what I view as a fundamental shift in the role of the CIOs and rethinking where they're spending their energy and how they provide services to the American people. I've pointed out in the past around how we've seen tremendous value when technologists in the government are not focused purely on building networks and data centers. We're actually really, really focused on how do we fundamentally re-engineer and rethink the way we provide services. Why can't your experience when you're dealing with a government be very similar to your experience when you're dealing with consumer-based companies, whether it's the airlines or hotels or restaurants? And part of what we're trying to do as we look at the cloud computing journey is make sure that people recognize that this is not a fad. You know, we've heard many fads in technology come and go. So let's look back at the last year. I was at the NASA Ames Research Center when I announced the federal government's cloud computing strategy. Well, what has happened since then? Well, three major companies, Google, Microsoft, and IBM earlier this week, all have stepped up to the challenge and they've launched .gov clouds. And they've addressed one of the biggest problems that the federal government has when it comes to migration to the cloud, which is security. And they've actually taken on that challenge and are providing cloud-based services in the context of federal government requirements around security. And in my mind, that was one of the most difficult challenges. Second thing, thanks to the hard work at GSA with Dave McLaurin and his team, Katie Lewin and a number of other people, we awarded to 11 vendors a blanket purchase agreement for infrastructure as a service in terms of contracts. Now, what does that do? What does that mean? Well, what it does is it enables federal agencies and CIOs now to move forward and begin leveraging those platforms. We also are in the process with a multi-agency coalition of putting together a major RFP government-wide for collaboration and email services. And even with the infrastructure as a service contracts that are in place, it wasn't just done in the context of the federal government. We purposely made sure that states and local governments and tribal governments could leverage those contracts. At my weekly meeting, I also have NASIO, the National Association of State CIOs, on the call, and I regularly sit down with the city CIOs to make sure that as a country, we're looking at the potential of cloud computing, especially in these tough fiscal times, and how we can leverage those services.
Vivek Kundra, the federal CIO, speaking at NIST yesterday on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. You can find out more about it at federalnewsradio.com. Federal News Radio's Max Kakis on site with me yesterday and listening to Vivek Kundra make this presentation, and more from Vivek in a moment at Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Join Jim Fleisig, November 18th at 12 noon, for his monthly series, The Federal Executive Forum. This month's program will discuss cloud computing initiatives in the federal government. The panel includes government leaders from the U.S. Army, DISA, and NIST. Don't miss the Federal Executive Forum. It's Thursday, November 18th at noon, right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and online at federalnewsradio.com. Sponsored by McAfee, Riverbed, and Red Hat.
Good news for the uninsured and the insured. U.S. Healthy People 2020 Network is now offering annual health physical to the public. Members receive comprehensive health assessments for hypertension, thyroid, kidney, osteoporosis, diabetes, cholesterol, heart screening, and more till the year 2020. Find out your risks for heart attack or stroke. Take the extra step you and your family need to stay healthy till 2020 and beyond. Call 301-386-2223 or visit ushealthypeople2020.org for details. Sponsored by Prevent First, a nonprofit health organization.
The latest from the Federal Security Spotlight, brought to you by Cisco.
Government and industry share information on cybersecurity voluntarily. Will that partnering relationship change? Well, it depends. Here's Dave Powner, Director of Information Technology Management Issues at the Government Accountability Office.
We're on a course to pursue the voluntary arrangement. You know, right now I think there's some good progress with the voluntary partnership, but the bottom line is we're not meeting each other's expectations. So that's going to be a tough policy call for any administration moving forward.
To hear the entire show, log on to federalnewsradio.com. Will the top-of-mind security issues of today be the issues facing government tomorrow? Get the latest from federal experts on FISMA reform, the cyber initiative, how government is combating botnets, spyware, and other cyber evils, and more. Listen to Federal Security Spotlight, sponsored by Cisco, airing Thursday from 10 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m. or on demand at federalnewsradio.com. The Federal Security Spotlight is brought to you by Cisco, the leader in federal IT security.
WashingtonCaps.com is the destination for behind-the-scenes coverage of your Washington Capitals. Get the latest news, stats, schedules, analysis, and info about your favorite Caps players. Explore Caps 365, the multimedia section where you can access podcasts, exclusive player interviews, live pregame shows, video highlights, and much more. Check it all out on WashingtonCaps.com. Red is Caps Hockey.
Connect with more than 800 fellow contract management professionals. The Government Contract Management Conference is a must-attend on December 9th and 10th. The National Contract Management Association presents more than 20 educational sessions to answer the most complex questions, plus prominent speakers from CACI, the Department of Defense, the Boeing Company, and more. To learn more, visit ncmahq.org today.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Cloud Computing Forum and Workshop at the National Institute of Standards and Technology yesterday featured a keynote presentation from Federal Chief Information Officer Vivek Kundra. Another highlight from his presentation yesterday.
If you look at what happened in L.A., my good friend there, Randy Levin, she moved to the cloud. I was just with Carol Post, who's the CIO of New York City. They're moving to the cloud in terms of New York City. The state of Wyoming is moving to the cloud. 10,000 users have inked a deal for the entire state to move over to start using cloud services. The state of California. Last time I was talking here, we talked about 30-plus case studies at the federal, state, and local government level. So when you look at this movement by government to the cloud, coupled with the private sector rising to the challenge and providing innovative solutions, it's a one-way street in terms of where we're headed with cloud computing. But as Pat astutely pointed out, there are a number of issues that we need to be able to address and work on, and we look to you to help us as we move forward on this journey, because what we want to make sure is that as we think about policies, as we think about security, it's not done so in an abstract, closed ecosystem, but it's done so in an open, participatory fashion so we can be the beneficiaries of everybody's thinking. I was just with the World Economic Forum yesterday on cloud computing, and we talked about not just issues around data portability and interoperability, but what is the future when we think about data sovereignty? As data begins to move across multiple boundaries, not just at the state and local level, but within nation states. We have to think about the governance models. We have to think about the policy framework, the multilateral agreement. So those are all open questions that we need to consider from a policy perspective. At the same time, from a security perspective, for CIOs, what's really, really important is we've got to make sure that we've got the right level of security controls in place as we move forward with the cloud. That's why we launched the FedRAMP process. And this week, we actually released a set of proposed controls and a model to certify cloud solutions government-wide. And the reason that's really important is because we want to make sure that from an economics perspective, as cloud vendors sell into the government, they're not doing so in a fragmented manner where they're negotiating with every bureau, every agency, but that we can come together and make sure that we create a framework that allows us to manage risk to an acceptable level and also to shift our security posture so it's much more in line with a continuous monitoring approach rather than a paperwork generation approach. But I would urge you to look at those controls, help us think through, you know, what are we missing? What have we added that shouldn't be there? We're looking for very robust input as we shape the future of cloud computing within the public sector. And the reason I wanted to highlight the state and local government initiatives is because we're working very closely with them. So it's really, really important that the standards that we're going to be advancing, the standards that we're going to be accelerating, that once they are hardwired, it's going to be much more difficult to come back and try to re-engineer them. So therefore, it's vital that we get them right from the beginning. And it's vital that we get them right by partnering with you and making sure that we're asking the tough questions. And it's also vital when we think about it in the context of the global community as far as how do we make sure, you know, when we're looking at this larger migration to the cloud and we think about abstracting the physical layer and as we think about service grids, what does that world look like? What is the appropriate policy framework? And what are the standards and technical controls that need to be in place that will enable us to actually drive innovation rather than security becoming a pure impediment to innovation? We've got to be able to balance both of them. So with that, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to come on this rainy day. And I want to, you know, recognize the great work that NIST and GSA and Department of Homeland Security, Department of Defense, and countless agencies across the federal government have done to move us forward. And, you know, as I head back now to the White House, very focused on the 2012 budget, I've got to tell you, on top of mind for me as I'm evaluating agency budgets is to make sure whether it's the data center consolidation effort and targets that we're setting or migration to the cloud, that a cloud-first policy is central to our thinking around how we're hardwiring capital across the federal government. So with that, I want to thank you for taking the time, and I look forward to your very, very active participation.
Vivek Kundra at the Cloud Computing Workshop and Forum at the National Institute of Standards and Technology yesterday on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. More about the presentation by Vivek available now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.